Hi, Dean Hobbs. Welcome again to KABU.
Hi, Bill. I'm so happy to be back.
Dean Hobbs is a historian, a musicologist, a cultural critic, works, actually professors at the University of Michigan. Dean's book, Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music, examined the progressive currents in country music. In it, she critiques the prevalent portraits of working people in this country as somehow deficient, racist, misogynist, anti-gay, narrow-minded, bigoted, the deplorables, as Hillary Clinton called Trump supporters. That deficiency portrait is in sharp contrast to how a big majority of social and political critics describe their own stratum, who they see as tolerant, thoughtful, enlightening, fighting racism, accepting multiple sexualities. And in general, they see themselves made of better stuff, and thus, of course, deserving their privilege and higher incomes and domination of the decision-making. Dean Hobbs is one of those too few academics who try to dispel both of those portraits, both quite wrong, but they persist, because these are dominant stereotypes expressed in near all areas of U.S. life and the way working people are treated and not treated, and hospitals and schools and real estate offices. And it's in America's fiction and many fictions. And these stereotypes and images are particularly on display in writing and reports of those who analyze politics, particularly their analyses of who voted for Trump. In this interview, we discussed the 2020 election and who actually voted for Trump. And then we discussed Dean Hobbs' studies of country music that challenged the deficiency portrait of working people, and particularly, of course, the content of country music. First, though, Dean Hobbs, tell us about your journey, how you went from making music, to studying popular musical culture, particularly country music. Your studies that challenge the deficiency portrait. How did you get there?
Well, first, Bill, thank you for that introduction. I love how you put all that, and I really agree with your perspective on how the working class is positioned in relation to what I call, in my book, Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music, the narrating class. So if I talk about my journey, it is a journey from the working class in what is now the Rust Belt. I grew up in the industrial north of Ohio around Lake Erie. My dad worked on the railroad. By the time he retired, he had been driving freight trains for a while. Before that, he did different jobs on the railroad. My mom's twin sister and her husband, they owned a tavern in a tiny farm town in Ohio, population 300, and they had just the greatest jukebox that was majority country, and it was golden age country, so that was part of my musical education. Yeah, I was a musician. I went to college as a first-gen student. I wound up going on and became a musicologist, and that took me to University of Michigan for my PhD. I was 25 by the time I came to this elite upper middle class bastion, and it totally freaked me out. I had never been around people like this or in this kind of context, and so it was a kind of trial by fire. Fortunately, after that really alienating experience, my first job as a professor was in Detroit at Wayne State University, which got me back with a bunch of first-gen students and lots of a really diverse bunch of largely working class students. Then I wound up getting a job back here at University of Michigan, and I do teach a lot of elite students, and it's great because I get to teach elite students and a lot of poor and working class students nowadays on topics of class and inequality. We had a student-led initiative actually that started 2 years ago, a new minor in class and inequality studies at Michigan. It's the only one of its kind. And I teach the required course for that minor, and I teach a course called Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music that's also heavily focused on class. So that allows me to meet a lot of the working class students we have at Michigan and to see how eager more privileged students are to learn about class worlds that they don't know.
And you look at country music also as an area that has enormous progressive influences.
I do. So, you know, country music is a form of popular culture, and it can be all over the map. There are some pretty conservative statements in country songs. There are statements in country songs that are not nearly as conservative as country haters believe they are. And then there have been some really progressive statements in country music, both country music of the past, which is some of what I've studied and written about, and even recent and contemporary country music. You know, it depends on what ears you bring to the music, sometimes, as to whether you perceive the progressivism in some of these songs.
Dean Hobbs, the elite disparagement of working people seems to me pervades academic study, like in their child-rearing, their taste in art, and of course what we're going to discuss in their politics, especially in the very loose way our pundits blame working people for the rise of Trump. They mostly contend it was the working class who supported Trump and gave us Trumpism. I know both of us have been examining essays by Kim Moody and Mike Davis that tell a very different story about the rise of Trump. What you see is important in their analysis.
So first of all, I really appreciate you emphasizing this topic. It's so important, and I feel like we're swimming upstream in trying to talk about it. I wrote about it in Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music. There, I quoted Ezra Klein, founder of Vox and media person who's been around for a little while, who points out that if you keep telling the same old story, you get your promotion and you get your story published far more easily in the media world than if you try to tell a new story. And so, you know, it is just reproachable and it's so lazy and damaging that the media keeps telling the same old story. And yes, these articles by Mike Davis and by Kim Moody, they give us stats and facts that tell a very different story. Even Nate Silver in 2017, once the post-election data were finally all available in the springtime of 2017 following the 2016 election, already Nate Silver in 538 was publishing a piece called The Mythology of Trump's Working Class Support. And yet this never became a story. You know, there are lots and lots of ways that story is wrong, and I'm sure we're not going to get to all of the ways that are pointed out by Kim Moody and Mike Davis even. But first of all, I think it's important to say that Trump's victory was disproportionately from the middle class and upper income voters. Another thing that's really important to point out is that the so-called working class voter needs to be defined more clearly and carefully, or we're always going to be trapped in this mythology. We hear that these are people without college degrees. Well, that's 70% of all Americans. Only 30% of Americans have a degree. And not all of that 70% of undegreed Americans is, in fact, working class. You have, for example, a lot of small business owners who are not members of the working class. There are lots and lots of ways that this whole mythology goes wrong. Upper income groups are overrepresented among voters, and they disproportionately elected Trump. There were some swing voters, the white working class voters in 2016, but that group that swung from Obama to Trump was significantly smaller than the drop in the number of people who voted from this sector. So more of them simply stayed home and didn't vote than swung from Obama to Trump. Why then do we keep getting this mythology? Well, I trace it back to earlier elections. It's been going on for decades. Through many election cycles that we get this story that was particularly crystallized and weaponized and profitized in 2004 with Tom Frank's blockbuster best-selling book, What's the Matter with Kansas? He didn't invent the story, but he told a story that a lot of middle-class readers really embraced, and he told it in a winning way that sounded authoritative. It didn't bring data to bear so much as it brought anecdotes to bear, and yet the narrating class really ate it up, and the story is, you know, back in the good old days, we had a sort of respectable working class, and they knew which side their bread was buttered on. They voted Democrat. After Reagan, more and more, he uses Kansas as his case study, more and more working class voters voted Republican, and they did so because the Republicans hated who they hate. White working class voters supposedly switched over to vote Republican because they love their guns, they hate the gays, they hate people of color, and they hate abortion. And in doing so, they shoot themselves in the foot because they are precisely, as the story goes, and it was so beautifully told and crafted by Tom Frank, they do it to their own detriment because the Republicans' policies, their economic policies, hurt these white working class voters more than anyone else. So these people are so dumb and also so hateful that they vote against their own best interests and those of their children, their families, their aging parents. And that's the story we have gotten. That book came out in 2004. The story had already been around a while, and the story is still with us.
Yeah, I have a critique of that book, actually. And I think he overemphasizes those cultural issues at the expense of the economic issues, because Kansas used to be the aviation capital of the world. Wichita and Topeka have these huge plants. Boeing originated there, then moved to the West Coast, of course. It deindustrialized Topeka and Wichita. All of the parts plants in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, they began leaving. And when they left, of course, there's a crisis. And they had the crisis of Rust Belt cities. My reading of Kansas is the Rust Belt center surrounded by all these rural agricultural areas that are very conservative and also depopulating.
Sounds like Michigan.
And the working class of Wichita and Topeka, many of them still there, they were angry, angry, angry at the Democrats for their trade stuff. I agree that the cultural issues were important, but I think the economic issues were ignored by Frank, that it was the failure of the Democrats to maintain New Deal politics. Instead of protecting the working class, they moved towards this politics of supposed enrichment of everybody through giving capitalists full freedoms, which was destroying the working class. And I think that partially explains it.
I agree that Democrats have, well, both parties have paid far too little attention throughout the neoliberal decades to the vast upward redistribution of wealth that has left the working class at exactly the same spot in wages today as they were in 1975, while the 10% and the 1% and the 0.1% particularly have been enriched vastly at their expense. I agree with that. Being a scholar of culture, I focused in Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music on cultural issues in relation to class. And I have to say that I don't think the narrating class is equipped to tell us, to report to us, in fact, what the cultural issues are among working class people. So my main focus in Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music was on sexuality in relation to the white working class. I grew up as a queer kid among working class people in a rural part of Ohio. I certainly encountered homophobia, but it was no worse than I would encounter in the middle class. And in fact, that was the homophobia that really scared me as I moved off into middle class worlds by going to college. You know, I use a vulgar David Allan Coe underground song, F. Anita Bryant, as my main example in relation to that. But middle class people to this day can't hear that song and hear its actual message right. They misinterpret the hell out of it. They think it's a homophobic song because he's saying, F. Anita Bryant, who the hell are you telling all them faggots that they can't be free? He had been in prison. He had had sex with men in prison. He knew what he was singing about, and it was an anti-homophobic song. It was a progressive song. So part of the problem is, at this point especially, we have such class segregation. The Yale scholar James C. Scott even called it class apartheid. The classes know each other so little, so poorly, that middle-class listener doesn't know a pro-queer country song if it bites them in the butt. They think they're hearing homophobic song because it's a country song and this guy has a little bit of a twang and he's talking about queer subjects, queer issues. It must be homophobic. So, you know, we're really bad off when it comes to that. And I don't trust Tom Frank or many other members of the narrating class to tell me anything reliable about cultural issues among white working class people or working class people of color, for that matter. One more little data point is that, in fact, the folks whose incomes were above $100,000, they're the only ones who voted in majority numbers for Trump. Only that group. Everyone below them voted in majority numbers for Biden. So 54% of those folks with incomes over $100,000 voted for Trump, 44% to 42% for Biden. It's virtually the mirror image of what folks below $100,000 did. So who is Trump's base? Is it the people who show up to those rallies? Some of them are, as we know, paid actors. And they're paid to look like a bunch of working class folk because that plays well. I'm not saying that no working class people were voting for Trump, but even according to the stats, we have just the reverse. In the 2020 election, 54 for Trump to 42 only if you're above $100,000. Just below that, 42 for Trump to 57 for Biden.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Dean Hubbs, a historian, musicologist, cultural critic. She teaches at the University of Michigan, teaches about inequality and the progressive currents in working class movements. We've discussed some of the progressive currents around eroticism or the many, many, many ways of being sexual. Working class is far more tolerant, actually, than their supposed betters. Let's talk about some of the other progressive currents in working class music, Dean Hubbs. To what extent does the growing inequality and precariousness enter into the songs that are listened to and popular? And to what extent is the environmental crisis, in fact, the need to reconstruct this country, are those themes beginning to reach the audiences?
Yes. Again, I think if you have the right ears, and if you're accustomed to country music, you will hear those themes coming into country songs. Country takes up its themes often from an angle, kind of obliquely. There's a kind of stereotype of country songs as being very sad, and there still are a lot of sad songs. I think the real peak of sad songs was in the honky-tonk era, but you still have a lot of sad country songs, but then there are also a lot of country songs that are about hard times, and they juggle the difficulty of the subject matter with maybe letting you cry in your beer and really get up in your feelings without depressing you. So there's this kind of juggling act going on. There's a lot of kind of positivity in country music, and so popular music critics in the Trump years have been writing at times about all the themes of unity in country songs and all the positivity in country songs. And I agree with that. Country songs are different from folk music, for example, that is really quite pointed about its politics at times. You and I were talking before this interview about the radicalism of a song like 9 to 5, but even that, you know, you think of the jaunty, bouncy 1980s pop country crossover vibe and groove of Dolly Parton's 9 to 5, and it is a radical song in terms of its labor versus management position. And yet, if you are a casual listener, you don't actually have to hear that. It may go right over your head, the radicalism of that song. And you may just love tapping your foot or, you know, shaking your booty and not have to face up to a more political message than you care to do. So I think that country songs leave that kind of space very often. I think there are lots of country songs that are very much about, I got to be out in the country, don't put me in the city, I won't last a day. And then you get laundry lists of what is so beautiful out here in the country. And those are environmental themes. But again, you don't need to think of a song like that in a political frame if you don't want to.
Dean Hobbs, one last issue. We've talked about how country music is becoming increasingly progressive, and that's one of the findings of almost all opinion surveys. More and more people are now supporting Medicare for All. Florida just voted for Trump, but it also voted by a huge margin, 15-20%, to raise the minimum wage in Florida to $15 an hour. There's tremendous amount of progressive sort of sentiment, and also just the advances that queer people have made over the last 20 or 30 years. There's been real advances, it seems to me, especially in working class life. Your sense of how all of those sentiments can inform real political action and build movements.
I agree with you. Society has become more progressive. It has become more progressive in the realm of acceptance of LGBTQ people. More people in the surveys show more progressive anti-racist views. And it is across classes, whether the narrating class knows that or not. And you see it in country songs. Carrie Underwood had a hit in 2018 in the Trump years called Love Wins. That in itself was a queer slogan, right, referring to the advent of same-sex marriage. That's her title, and her video shows folks immigrating. It's a sympathetic depiction of people who are struggling as immigrants moving through the world in a struggle. There are other songs that you and I talked about, and I hope you're going to be playing Eric Church's duet with Rhiannon Giddens from 2016, a number 9 country hit called Kill a Word. I think that these songs were all commentaries on the Trump era, on the division and the hate. That song is a song against hate. A lot of folks would have heard Tim McGraw's number 1 hit from 2016 called Humble and Kind. I always heard that song as a commentary on what kinds of human values are worth pursuing and, you know, leaving hate behind. Even Luke Bryan's 2018 top 5 hit, I Believe Most People Are Good, is another one. It has the progressive line that pops up in various country songs, Love Who You Love, which is heard by country listeners as a pro-LGBTQ line. So about what we might do from here. You know, I dream, I fantasize, I try to plan and scheme about what could work. First of all, we have ignored economically for 45 years the plight of working class people, whether they be white or black, indigenous, or people of color. Working class people have really gotten the shaft over the last 45 years. And that is statistically supported in spades, and we would need to do whole other shows to cover that. But I have this idea that keeps coming up in my mind of a book project that I might like to do. It would be a history of working class progressivism. And the point would be to educate, first of all, middle class and upper class people about the advances that we owe to the working class, and also to educate working class folk themselves, who so rarely can find any positive stories about themselves in our media landscape or in textbooks at school or anywhere. If we have positive stories about the working class, it's always the dead working class, the heroes of the working class past. You know, the contemporary working class, the working class people we actually live with, know. So I already have one chapter that could go into this book. It's in an article that I published a couple of years ago. I wrote this right after the Trump inauguration, and it's called Country Music in Dangerous Times. And I take a handful of songs. These songs happen to be from the 70s and 80s, but songs that were really progressive, including David Allan Coe's F. Anita Bryant, which is sexually progressive, others that were racially progressive, including the beautiful Merle Haggard song. Out of the hundreds and hundreds of songs he wrote, he always claimed it was his favorite, and it never became a famous hit. The record companies were far too conservative, didn't even want to release it. But it's called Irma Jackson. And I talked about this song, which was finally released in 1972, and it's about interracial love, forbidden interracial love. This man and woman, a white man who's singing the song, and a black woman who he grew up with, and they grew up together as kids. They loved each other all their lives. And now they're saying, we're going to have to leave each other because the world just can't accept us. And I started to wonder about this song, which Haggard had written back in 1967. And Haggard, of course, ironically, is best known for a really reactionary song, Okie from Muskogee. I bet you know the song. It was a huge number one crossover hit in 1968, and it was absolutely reactionary. Yeah. He was singing through the voice of a character, a narrator, but he forever got associated with that song. And, in fact, was the author of lots of other songs that have to be read as progressive, including Irma Jackson. And I started thinking, just after the Trump inauguration, in this paper, Country Music in Dangerous Times, which, by the way, is available in open access as an article on the internet, if you look up the title and my name. I started thinking that maybe when Merle Haggard wrote that song in 1967, it's very likely he might have written it in relation to Mildred and Richard Loving, the biracial couple, a white man and a black woman from Virginia, who had been ripped out of their beds in 1958 by the cops because they had dared to fall in love and get married and have a family together. And they fought it all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they were the working class heroes who gave us interracial marriage. So it was the 50th anniversary of that Supreme Court decision. In 2017, when I wrote this, I realized that even though there was a feature film that came out that year about this couple, the Lovings, I think the film was just called Loving. The case, of course, was Loving v. Virginia. But they had never been celebrated specifically as working class American heroes, and they need to be. It would really, I think, have an impact if we started to identify the progressive heroes who we celebrate as working class when they were, in fact, working class progressivists. That's the powerful thing that could be perhaps transformative. What if we start identifying progressive heroes as working class when they've been working class folks? We have such an underdeveloped vocabulary of class in the United States, except for all the shadowy code language, right, by which we point fingers at the working class. Okay, yeah, in political seasons, people talk about working class voters, but in the same way that we celebrate if a certain contribution came from a woman or a BIPOC person, we need to start celebrating progressive contributions that came from working class people and identify them as such.
Dean Hubbs, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Such a pleasure, and thank you for the work you do, Bill. I look forward to next time.
Thanks a lot.